History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media. MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
Here's my plan to dismantle the deep state and reclaim our democracy from Washington corruption once and for all. And corruption it is. First, I will immediately reissue my 2020 executive order restoring the president's authority to remove rogue bureaucrats, and I will wield that power very aggressively. Second, we will clean out all of the corrupt actors in our national security and intelligence apparatus, and there are plenty of them.
That was Donald Trump in a campaign video last year outlining his sweeping plans to shatter what he invariably refers to as the deep state. It's a sweeping agenda that targets officials at the CIA, the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Pentagon. Anybody that the now president-elect believes had thwarted his agenda and disrupted his administration the first time he was in office. But Trump's plans don't stop there. In his video, Trump vowed to appoint a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to expose deep state spying. And even more ominously, launch a major crackdown on government leakers who, as he put it, collude with the fake news to weave false narratives about him. And, whenever possible, press criminal charges. With the surprising news that Trump has picked Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz to be his attorney general, the idea that Trump will actually go through with these plans suddenly seems more real than ever. How will all this go down if Trump, Gaetz as his enforcer, really does start going after his political enemies? And how will it affect the national security agencies whose job it is to keep Americans safe? We'll discuss with Mark Zaid, one of Washington's foremost national security lawyers, on this episode of Spy Talk. Mark Zaid, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thank you, Mike.
So I was trying to think of the ideal guest to talk about Trump's plans for the deep state, and I immediately thought of you. You're a national security lawyer who has represented countless officials at the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies. Trump's plans seem pretty explicit, targeting so-called corrupt officials in the intelligence community, firing rogue bureaucrats, launching a major crackdown on government leakers who, as he puts it, collude with the fake news to expose deep state spying. But I'm sorry, we have to start out with the stunning news that Trump has just chosen Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, a full-blown MAGA firebrand, as his attorney general, just moments after confirming that former Democratic Congressman Tulsi Gabbard will be director of national intelligence. I tremble to ask, but what do you make of this?
I make that, you know, as we learn more, it almost just like can't get worse in so many different ways. I mean, here you have an individual, Matt Gaetz, who even his own party members were hesitant to back him through numerous ethics investigations. He's let his law license slip a bunch of times. I've seen inconsistent reporting on whether he even still has a current law license, but I'm sure we'll find that out. But given the allegations that were against him with respects to sex trafficking and underage sex with minors, which maybe that's redundant to say it in that way, but to make it clear for everyone, I mean, does he really want to be under oath for confirmation hearings? Oh, my God, this is going to be a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is, I mean, it's been publicly reported, the Justice Department has concluded its investigation into Gaetz and these allegations, but the House Ethics Committee investigation of Gates for having sex with underage females is still ongoing. So how does somebody serve as attorney general? I guess he's leaving the House, so right. he can't. The Ethics Committee investigation goes away, presumably.
Well, look, you know, the only thing I have to remind listeners of is to the extent that there could be pending charges, possible charges, anything, or even just real adverse information about Matt Gaetz is two words: Michael Flynn. You know, who, of course, we haven't heard about yet in the incoming administration. We'll see what happens with Michael Flynn. But I'm referring specifically to the fact that the Obama administration specifically warned Donald Trump to, I think, President Obama, as I recall, specifically telling, you know, president to president or president-elect that Michael Flynn had some serious national security concerns and you might want to think twice about bringing him into your administration. And yet Trump didn't care and still brought him in as national security advisor. And less than 2 weeks later, he was gone.
Right. But look, yes, but Gates in charge of the most sensitive department in the United States government, in many ways. I mean, how do you imagine this will go down among the career lawyers at the Justice Department, at the career agents at the FBI and other agencies under the Justice Department's purview? I mean, it is, I gotta say, my mind is blown here.
I don't think it's going to go over well, other than any MAGA representatives who are inside the Justice Department, of which I'm sure there are. Now, you know, I think most people don't realize that there are certain people in government who automatically, by virtue of their position, have access to classified information. They are deemed trustworthy by their very position. That is the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, Article 3 federal judges, district judges, circuit courts of appeal judges, Supreme Court justices, not magistrate justices, and members of Congress, both House and Senate. So by virtue of being elected to the House, Matt Gaetz was automatically deemed trustworthy and possible, if the agencies were, if he needed it, would have access to classified information. Who's not on that list is the Attorney General of the United States and other cabinet officers in every administration. They go through the same background investigation that I, who holds a security clearance, and millions of other people each year go through. He's got to fill out an SF-86, a standard form 86. He'll have a background investigation, and there will have to be a determination as to whether he's trustworthy to have access to classified information. That all said, the President of the United States can just wave his magic wand and say, we're giving you access no matter what. We don't want a background investigation. So there's a lot that could happen going forward to see. And while this is a blow your mind, as you said, nomination, we will see, you know, where and who lasts. If you think about the, you know, the old game of the with the chairs, you know, the musical chairs. We'll see. Right now, everybody's got a chair, and we'll see how many of those chairs are still around come January 20th.
Tulsi Gabbard. What do you make of her as a DNI?
Yeah, you know, look, Tulsi Gabbard. Objectively speaking, a fantastic resume, right? Lieutenant Colonel. Have military experience, intelligence experience, congresswoman. Do I think that she is the person for the DNI? That would not be my first choice, that's for sure.
You are an elected president, so but, you don't you get know, to choose.
There's been a lot of cabinet officers in every administration who, you know, probably are not the most qualified or the best qualified. The question more for all of Trump's nominees, appointees, is more about the loyalty sycophant aspect than necessarily their qualifications. I mean, look, theoretically, you don't have to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court. And in modern times, that seems unheard of. But there are a lot of people, if you're a good manager and you have good people underneath you, that they could conceivably do a good job. That said, Rex Tillerson, who was fantastic in the defense contracting world, right, was horrible as Secretary of State. It didn't work out well. He also just crossed swords with Donald Trump because he wasn't a sycophant. But so, you know, it's hard to say. I think all of these choices, the majority, and certainly the more recent ones, they are more mind-blowing choices and unexpected than anything else. And yeah. I have a feeling we're going to see a lot of people up in arms. But I've also seen, you know, we've also heard today that most of the networks now, if not every network, has called the House to be maintained as Republican. Right. And I saw one Texas Republican congressman basically saying, I'll paraphrase only because I don't remember the exact wordage, but it was basically, he said, if Donald Trump tells us to jump 3 feet high on 1 foot, that's what we're going to do. So this is the concern.
You mentioned confirmation hearing for Gates. Now, I am skeptical that there could even be one. And this may explain, you know, Trump's social media posts last week saying that he wanted the Senate to go into recess so he can make recess appointments, you know, bypassing the entire confirmation process. Because a confirmation hearing for any AG pick, but certainly Matt Gaetz, you know, every question from every Democrat will be, are you going to take direction from the White House about who you're going to investigate and who you're going to prosecute? And it's hard for me to imagine a palatable answer that Matt Gaetz could give at such a proceeding.
Mr. Gaetz, I'm Senator so-and-so from the state of whatever. Did you ever have sex with an underage female? Is he going to plead the fifth? I don't know. I mean, yeah. this is going to be, he's going to have some really good preparation.
Yeah. I mean, look, he'll say no to that. But what I don't know is how he would answer the question about, you know, are you going to use your office as attorney general to target and get retribution against Donald Trump's political enemies taking direction from the White House?
I suspect it will be a similar answer in the sense from our Supreme Court justices of how important precedent means, at least until it doesn't mean much.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of attorney generals of years past, Edward Levy. I mean, a lot of them may be turning over in their graves. But look, I want to get back to Trump's plans for the deep state and his claims that he'll be targeting so-called corrupt actors in the intelligence community. How nervous should officials at Langley, at FBI headquarters in Washington, and at the Pentagon be?
You know, we've been dealing with Trump's rhetoric for obviously all these years, and he says lots of things that he either never does or is clearly over the top. But I would be concerned if I was someone who had been in opposition to him, especially with inside the government or in the media. I think we are now well beyond the time to just ignore what he is saying, because it's not just him. It is his vice president nominee, electee, whatever one wants to say. It is the people surrounding him that he's bringing into his second administration, an administration that, per the Supreme Court, has given him greater power than we have ever seen before by a president of the United States. And I think people would be foolish and naive not to be concerned as to what might be coming, even if it never materializes.
So when he says, you know, clean out the corrupt actors in our national security and intelligence apparatus, how does he implement that? How does he go about doing that? And can he? This, I guess, gets tied into the whole Schedule F issue about whether he can reissue that executive order and fire large numbers of career government officials. But it still seems like a somewhat menacing course of action.
It is certainly menacing. It is beyond the executive order dealing with the civil service, because we're talking about the national security and intelligence community. And I'm actually not as concerned about Trump and his administration abusing laws than I am about actually using laws that already exist. Because the director of the CIA, the director of the DNI, the director of national intelligence inside the intelligence community already has and has had for decades the ability to literally just fire anyone under their employ without due process. They choose over the period of time because of policy and practice not to do that. They allow due process. We can debate how good, how viable, how significant due process is, but they have that ability. There is a statute on the books that, as far as I'm aware, has only been used against one of my clients in the last 40 years, because no one else has been able to give me another example, that allows the Defense Department to fire an employee and revoke their clearance without any due process. And I had it happen.
And wait, who has the power to do this? The Secretary of Defense, the CIA director, the FBI director, they all are empowered to fire people at will?
So it varies from agency to agency, and it's more about where within the community they are. But certainly employees of the CIA and employees of the Defense Department, at least, I have to go back and look at the statute. My client was a Defense Intelligence Agency, a DIA employee. And literally, and this was about 2009, 2010, this is the Obama administration. He was served with two letters. You're fired, signed by, I think it was, I'm trying to remember whether it was the DIA director or the Secretary of Defense, and your clearance is revoked, no due process. I reversed through Secretary Gates, Bob Gates, I reversed the termination. I was never able to reverse the revocation of the clearance, and the statute, which was from the mid-80s, as I recall, allowed that to occur. So they already have the authority to do this and wipe out the corrupt actors in our national security and intelligence apparatus, which is from Trump's own statements. Of course, I don't know what that means. It's whatever he thinks or wants it to mean.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I look through this list, it does seem, you know, entirely drafted through the prism of his own experiences as president. The allegations about Russia, the Mueller investigation, and all the attenuated aspects of it. And I just wonder if you think it goes beyond that. I mean, is this all about him trying to get retribution for the people who he believes went after him on bogus charges about Russia, or do you think it's broader than that?
You know, look, I think there is a core group of people who should be very concerned of retaliation directly by Trump, and we can all name them. You don't have to be in our world.
Name some of them.
You know, it's going to be John Brennan, Jim Clapper, Liz Cheney, but not for congressional work, not for like her work on the January 6th committee, because I think the Republicans in Congress are going to be really strong against the White House to say you cannot go after someone for work they did as a member, a sitting member of Congress, for obvious reasons. You know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and they don't want to face the same music in a future term. Jim Comey, Lisa Page, Peter Strzok.
I mean, but what can he do to them? I mean, he could strip them of security clearances to the extent that they still have them. And by the way, that is explicitly called for in Project 2025 revocation. But beyond that, I mean, so they lose their security clearances. I mean, is there something that they can do further?
Look, there's the old saying of, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich.
Right.
Are there laws where I think that could be abused or even used, like I said. I mean, look, here's one possibility. Hey, former government official X, who's been a thorn in the Trump side, I see that on March 23rd, 2024, you appeared on MSNBC talking about X, Y, and Z, and we at the CIA believe that information is classified, and we are now prosecuting you under the Espionage Act. Could that happen? Sure. Would that happen? I don't know.
Yeah.
I have clients come to me all the time, including former Trump cabinet officers who wrote books, right? You know, as you know, mm-hmm. I help clear books through the system to make sure that they have no classified information. And I've had countless clients who are incredibly experienced in the intel world tell me, I wrote my book not to have any classified information in it. I made sure of it. And I just always shake my head and go, well, wait to see what the agency says. And invariably, I rarely have seen an instance where an agency has come back and said, yeah, there's nothing classified. Do I agree with what they say is classified? Right. No, I usually don't. But they come back and say, you need to strip this from the book because it is classified.
I just want to go through some of the other items in this agenda and get your take on them. So number three, right after clean out all the corrupt actors in the intelligence apparatus, number three is totally reform FISA courts, which are so corrupt that the judges seemingly do not care when they're lied to in warrant applications. Now, this goes through the lens of the Russia investigation. The most prominent example would be the FISA warrant renewed four times against Carter Page, which came up empty and, you know, ultimately led to no charges. What do you make of that? Does he have a legitimate issue there about reforming FISA?
Well, I am 100% for reforming FISA and strengthening transparency with respect to FISA. You know, look, we learned following Ed Snowden's disclosures that a great deal of the FISA process can be declassified and the sky doesn't fall in the aftermath, that we could see how the court operates. I would take exception to the fact that the judges are lied to in warrant applications or that they don't care. And in fact, in the statement that he makes, he basically accuses them of being part of the problem, that they knowingly signed off on this. And this is an interesting situation because the left wing would very much support some of what he's saying by saying that the judges, you know, just rubber stamped FISA applications, which I've said repeatedly was not true either, because there was tons of back and forth between the FBI and the FISA court who would routinely reject without stamping it rejection and just tell the lawyers to go back and get more information until they brought sufficient information that allowed the judges to sign off on it. Yeah, there was one case where obviously there was a misstatement and a lawyer was prosecuted for it. But, you know, I'll just say I'm familiar sufficiently with the case and it's not exactly what it was in the public. And it really didn't make much of a difference. And even if it did, it was one example of years, right? FISA applications, the FISA court was created in 1978, as I recall. Right. So it's been around for, right, almost 50 years.
I mean, the figures that I think are annually published, it's usually they approve, you know, 99% of the applications they get from the FBI, which raises reasonable questions as to how thoroughly they look at them.
The FBI knows what works to gain permission, authorization from the FISA court, right? They know it's very much a checkbox. You know, this is what we need to do. Now, in the aftermath of Snowden, they created a process by which there's a 5-person panel of independent, you know, overseers or observers to play sort of a pushback role, right? You know, to push back on what the FBI says. And I'm sure that process could be expanded and strengthened without a doubt.
So going down the list, we will establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to declassify and publish all documents on deep state spying, censorship, and corruption. And there are plenty of them.
Yeah, wow. Truth and Reconciliation, for those who are knowledgeable about international events, you know, that's South Africa. Wow. Are we right. South Africa and dealing with apartheid and lynchings and murders? I mean, that because that's what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa was involved. You know, if you look back to 2020, John Ratcliffe, who was then the DNI, released selectively declassified information that his own CIA and others with and members of Congress on the Intelligence Committee pushed back on, saying this was totally inappropriate for you to release this raw intelligence data because the president told him to do so because it was going to harm sources and methods. So the problem, of course, is the president of the United States, whoever that ever is, has the authority to declassify anything they want. Right. And certainly the director of the DNI or the director of the CIA has that authority. I understand. I think there's one aspect of where either they did it or he wants to do it to give the FBI director greater authority to declassify intelligence information that would have otherwise been in the purview of the intelligence community. And of course, we understand that Chris Wray, even though the FBI directors are on 10-year terms, is on the chopping blocks of perhaps being fired in the next incoming administration. So right. I hope, and this is, again, so much of what we're talking about is going to be, we need to just wait and see. I hope there's going to be significant pushback from the career officials, even the Republican officials within the intelligence community and who have had oversight on the Hill to say, look, sir, don't do this. This is going to be dangerous to the integrity of the United States and our role in the process. I mean, are the Five Eyes, which are, you know, our top allies or other allied countries not going to share intelligence information with us if we just willy-nilly release it simply because it makes the next administration look better or makes his enemies look bad?
Number five, we will launch a major crackdown on government leakers who collude with the fake news to deliberately weave false narratives and to subvert our government and our democracy. And when possible, we will press criminal charges.
Yeah, so I'll interview you. Hey, Michael Isikoff, in the years you've been a journalist, have you ever written a story based on classified information that was leaked to you?
Yes, on multiple occasions.
Then according to what Trump said in his own words, you are potentially facing criminal penalties. And the reality is the law allows it. The Espionage Act of 1917, which hasn't been amended since the Korean conflict, allows prosecution of those who transmit, publish, disseminate national defense information, which in the modern era is the same for classified information, and there is no First Amendment defense. There is no journalistic privilege. And based on what he said, just reading it as he said, his words is that, you know, you, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, whomever might publish classified information that embarrasses him for the first time really in history, you know, assuming you push aside Julian Assange as to whether or not he was a journalist or a publisher, there will be prosecution of journalists.
I should point out, speaking up for myself and my profession, that had people not leaked classified information, we would not have known about the dissents within the U.S. intelligence community to the claims about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. We would not have known about CIA black sites for people nabbed after 9/11. We would not have known about waterboarding and all the excesses that led most people to conclude, including government agencies, that this constituted torture by the U.S. government. There's a lot of things that have been central to our democratic debate that we would not have been able to engage in had not some of these classified secrets been leaked.
And no one objectively should debate that, but you can put that on a plaque and bring it with you into your jail cell.
Well, I hope I would hire a lawyer such as you to make sure that doesn't happen. But
the problem. This is the problem. The way the law is written, and there have been First Amendment defenses that have been levied, attempted, argued by those who have been prosecuted. They have all failed. Mm-hmm. And on, you know, Congress is not stepping in anytime soon, certainly in this next administration, to modify it. And I would not want to be the one who is the test subject for it. That, you know, that's all right. I could say. The policy and practice has always been not to prosecute journalists. You know, we've seen a little bit encroachment on that with respect to serving warrants on journalists' phone records, tapping some phones inside the AP. An unindicted co-conspirator as a Fox News reporter to send a message. And there was such significant pushback against the Obama administration for doing it. New policies were put in place, policies not to have a practice of going after journalists.
Right. That has been that Merrick Garland, as attorney general, yes, made it clear that the Justice Department would no longer do that. Of course, you know, I should point out that the height of that actually took place of warrants, of subpoenas for journalists' phone records actually took place during the Obama years. And then were sort of curbed back.
And look, you know, it was the first Trump administration who did. And I do not believe Julian Assange is a journalist. But for those who do, let's take that as the position. It was the Trump administration who indicted Assange after the Obama administration had decided it wasn't worth the policy blowback that would occur as a result. And in fact, the first indictment against him, which was just one count, wasn't even an attack on him in his journalistic air quotes status. It was the amended complaint, the revised charges that brought into play the dissemination transmission, which was more like what a journalist does. So they've already sort of telegraphed. Now, I've always spoken back and said, look, that is not necessarily the slippery slope, because one case is not a slippery slope. But if there's a second case, then you got to start looking at a slippery slope. So we'll see.
Here's another one. Ask Congress to establish an independent auditing system to continually monitor our intelligence agencies to ensure that they're not spying on our citizens or running disinformation campaigns against the American people, or that they are not spying on someone's campaign like they spied on my campaign.
So Congress obviously already has that authority post Watergate and Church Commission. That's what the right. House Select Committee on Intelligence and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, the HPSI and the CISI, that's their job. I mean, so Congress already has that. They don't need an independent auditing system. But what they're talking about with respect to, you know, running information campaigns, do you mean exercising their First Amendment rights? Right? Because that's what the 51 former intelligence officials who signed the Hunter Biden laptop letter, and I represent more than half a dozen of them, that's what they did. They cleared the letter through the CIA, who gave them permission in the sense that it did not contain classified information. And the law is either it has classified information or you have a First Amendment right to publish it. There is no in between.
And now, of course, in that case, you know, if we had somebody from the Trump side here, or even not necessarily the Trump side, but who might say, look, they had a First Amendment right, those former intelligence officials, but they were wrong. The laptop was real. It was authenticated by the FBI, and it was used in the court proceedings against Hunter Biden.
Yeah, but if you read the letter is a beautifully written Washington, D.C. lawyeristic letter. It says everything and nothing at the same time. It is completely caveated where they say outright they don't know if, in fact, it is real or not. What they are concerned about, or were concerned, still concerned about, was that Russia was using it for an information campaign to promote an agenda. And I think they were correct about that. But that, you know, that's a policy dispute. You know, look, tons of people are wrong all the time on both ideological sides as to what they say. And the question is, do they have a First Amendment to say it or not? And should they be subject to the wrath of a president of the United States if they get something wrong?
Good point. Let's take a break now. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of the items in his agenda that you actually applaud. We'll be back. And we're back. When we left off, I pointed out that there were some items in Trump's list for the deep state that our distinguished guest, Mark Zaid, actually thinks might be a good idea. I'm guessing that one of them is for accelerated declassification of documents.
Sure, absolutely. Look, I have spent my entire 30 plus year career trying to advocate for transparency and litigating cases to ensure proper declassification. And there is rampant overclassification. We've known that for decades. You know, more than 50% it has been admitted to by senior government officials in both administrations, Republican and Democrat, that there is too much classification, there is overclassification, and that there is information that could long ago been declassified. So sure, that is great. You know, and as we go through the list of the several things here that actually have some merit, the problem is every single one of them then has that follow-on sentence that ties it to root out the deep state, vindicate me, I want revenge. But, you know, if we could come up with better system, and we've been working, lots of people have been working on it, including the Biden administration, to use artificial intelligence, AI, to strengthen and expedite declassification, you know, to allow the computer system to assess and review millions and millions of pages of documents that humans just don't have the time to do, to determine, you know, actually, look, here's a document of which is still classified, but 92% of the information was declassified, you know, 12 years ago. I mean, we see that happen all the time.
My sense, having been through this many times over the years, is that real declassification only happens when it's in the political interest of the powers that be, or they're under political pressure to do so. That's when you get declassification. You know, in particular, going back to when the Senate report, both the 9/11 Commission and also the Senate report on Iraqi WMD, there was enormous political pressure to release stuff that had not previously been out there. And then it happened. But if you leave it to the career people, their default is always going to be exceedingly cautious not to declassify.
No, I absolutely agree. Look, I think it was the New York Times, I recall, just recently lost a FOIA case trying, and it might have been another entity, so it doesn't matter, but trying to get information regarding the Senate torture report declassified, which there's been a big push for people to do, but for the most part still is classified. Or let's look at the JFK assassination records, which Trump has routinely said he was going to, you know, declassify everything. Well, he was the president at the time when the law, expired in the sense when it was enacted in 1992. It said everything subject to it has to be declassified and released by 2017, 25 years. And that was postponed. And then before he had to do it, apparently Mike Pompeo, then CIA director, went over to the White House and told Trump not to do it. And he didn't. Now, I'll caveat that by saying, I don't think there's anything in there that would make a darn difference if you were.
that was my next question. Do you think there's
mean, it would be great for history. I think there'll be some really interesting information that historians would devour, but there's not going to be anything There's very few documents that will even pertain to November 22nd, 1963. Yeah. I helped write what the definition of an assassination records was as it's applied with the review board. But, you know, Trump has said he's going to declassify everything. So, look, knock yourself out. More power to it. Do it. But you didn't do it the first administration either. And I don't think it will make a difference.
9/11 is another big area where people have pushed for declassification mostly. And we've actually gotten quite a bit more in the last few years about the FBI's investigation into Saudi involvement, possible Saudi involvement. And a lot came out that we didn't know in the years many of us were writing and reporting on 9/11, and that the 9/11 Commission itself didn't have.
Yeah, so we will see. But of course, we know Jared Kushner does a lot of business with the Saudis.
yes, we do. And he does seem to be, although he said he doesn't want to be back in the government, he does seem to have a role as a senior advisor. Another one that seems, pretty easy for people to endorse: work to ban federal bureaucrats from taking jobs at the companies they deal with and that they regulate.
Yeah, look, that's that. There's been a revolving door for years. You know, very often we see a federal employee is working for their agency on Friday, and then all of a sudden on Monday, they're working at a defense contractor that was working on some of the same things. Now, there are ethics rules that apply, that exist, and there are some rules where a government official who works specifically on a project is permanently in perpetuity, you know, never allowed to work on that. And there are others where it is a matter of time. You have to have a year go by or whatever the framework is that exists. I would have no objection to strengthening the ethical boundaries between the exchange of government officials or transfer and individuals. I mean, I'm trying to figure out, you know, how Elon Musk is going to cut, fire all these employees, you know, with the U.S. government, where already most federal agencies that I deal with are already taxed to the max that they don't have enough people to do work. So what are you going to do? You're just going to hire contractors to do the job? That's a big issue and has been one for years and is going to cause a lot of problems.
Given all the massive interests that Elon Musk has with interactions with various tentacles of the federal government, how is he going to be able to serve in this position of, you know, director of government efficiency and order around government agencies that may be interacting with Tesla or his rocket company or many of his other interests?
Yeah, we don't know, right? Is this going to be a federal agency? They say no. Is it going to be something within the White House itself? Will it be subject to the Federal Advisory Committees Act? Will it be subject to FOIA? Will it be like, for those who can remember back, as I know you do, Hillary Clinton's health care task force, you know, which caused all sorts of controversy? I mean, there are a lot of questions that will come up as to how this operates, who has oversight over it. Are they being paid to do this work? Are they going to be benefiting by making recommendations that what they say to cut in government is actually just being transferred to the contracting world, which, guess what, they run? Mm-hmm. We'll see.
What, as I mentioned before, Kash Patel, the MAGA zealot, was not named as the CIA director, which people had been floating before. Instead, it went to John Ratcliffe, the former member of Congress, member of the Intelligence Committee, and director of National Intelligence towards the end of Trump's first term. What do you make of that pick?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Look, everything so far, he's putting loyalists into these positions. Some of them are clearly controversial, but he's entitled to do it. There are questions as to how qualified some of them are. Will they, in fact, be confirmed even before a Republican-controlled Senate, like Pete Hegseth, the Defense Department selectee, apparently. There's questions as to whether or not he will be able to survive a confirmation process.
Will there even be confirmation hearings? Wasn't Trump was pushing for the Senate to go into recess so he can make recess appointments and therefore does not have to have his people go through confirmation hearings. And I could well understand why he would want to go that direction.
And I don't know how significant the confirmation process will frankly be, because we saw in the first Trump administration that there were countless senior execs like the Secretary of DHS who were in an acting capacity for years at a time. I mean, the deputy and secretary of DHS were both.
And of course, for the DOD secretary, Hegseth, I'm sure there will be, if there is a confirmation hearing, and I'm not so sure there will be, will he allow military troops to participate in the mass deportations or make arrests at the border, essentially violating the Posse Comitatus Act?
Yeah. I mean, look, there's going to be a lot of litigation. And the problem with litigation is, as we saw in Jack Smith's prosecutions of Donald Trump, is it can take a long time. And by the time these cases wind their way through the courts, you know, it could be the next administration of whomever that might be, because of how long appeals could take. So, look, I don't have good answers for anything, because it's a lot of wait and see. I can only highlight the concerns that exist based on, frankly, the existing laws in place of what could be done by a president of the United States and their designees if they so choose to do so. And because the Supreme Court has given almost blanket immunity to the president for every official act they do, we are in for an incredible roller coaster ride in the next administration. I'll finish just saying the other point in this 10-pointer or whatever it was, where he talks about making inspector general's offices independent and physically separated from the departments they oversee. I love it. I've been suggesting that for years.
Yeah.
I think inspector general's offices should investigate an agency for which they have no relationship whatsoever, so that they don't know the people that they're investigating, because the universe of the intelligence community and law enforcement is, even though there might be tens of thousands of employees at the leadership level, it's a very, very small world. And they all know one another. And I've seen that firsthand to be a problem. But then, of course, he ends the sentence with, so that they do not become the protectors of the deep state. You know, it's ironic, because I've been accused by his first administration of being part of the deep state, whereas, you know, I've always been the one challenging the so-called deep state, which I did not believe existed. What we see being created now is what is the deep state. It's not what the Trump administration...
Would you just explain that a little bit? That's interesting
notion
observation.
And it's not even a deep state. It's the overt state. It's the clear telegraphing by this incoming administration of putting in loyalists to just do what the king-in-chief, commander-in-chief says. That, to me, is the functionality of the deep state, right? What the deep state historically has meant is this subversive government that no one knows about, that's really pulling the strings. And that's why I'm not as actually concerned about the nominee picks we've seen so far. I want to see who the deputy CIA director is going to be, who's a non-confirmed position. I want to see who their chiefs of staff are going to be. I want to see if these people are just figureheads and are just going to do what the White House tells them to do. That to me is the real deep state, but it's not very deep. It's surface level. It's the iceberg. I see the iceberg.
Well, to wrap up here, as we were going through the negatives and the few positives you have identified, it occurred to me that there's one big other positive for you, which is if Trump actually implements some of these ideas, it's going to mean a lot more business for national security lawyers like you representing government officials.
That is true, although the problem's going to be is much of what they would do in the national security arena is unreviewable by federal courts. And it's been that way for decades.
Right.
So, I mean, I feel almost neutered even before the process began, because what, and this is, it's a horrible feeling, believe me, because I'm already experiencing it, of like, what exactly are we going to do to challenge this action? I can bring a case in federal court for some of it to ask for a preliminary injunction. And depending on which judge, maybe I'll get that. Will the next administration actually adhere to what a federal judge says? Or, you know, they certainly can appeal it. And we'll see what happens down the line. But in the meantime, you know, if a federal employee is told, you better get off our premises or we are going to arrest you, effectively, they will have removed that employee, whether we sue or not. So again, look, I hope that the second Trump administration is the best presidential administration we have ever seen, that they only do great things for America, that all of this has been rhetoric, and we don't see anything other than the normal roller coaster where I see the left will hate what the right's doing, the right will hate what the left's doing. But those of us kind of in the middle, a moderate, a little bit left, a little bit right, we just, you know, go on with our business until the next administration comes in. But I don't know if that's going to be the case this time.
Mark Zaid, I want to thank you for joining us. And it occurs to me, as the administration moves forward, we're going to have many other occasions to come back to you to get your take on.
Yeah, hopefully I will be here and not in Guantanamo.
Okay. Good luck to you and to myself and the rest of other reporters.
You'll be in the cell with me. I have no doubt.
We can pass notes. Okay. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Yeah, anytime, Mike. I mean, we'll see. It's, I don't know. I'm trying not to, I'm not being the boy who cries wolf or Chicken Little, the sky is falling, but the writing is on the wall as to what could happen, what they say is going to happen. And the question is, will it happen? And I hope it never will, but we'll see.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.